Coming up on What's Bugging Me. Where's the media outrage over the FBI and the Democrats pressuring Twitter to censor the New York Post and the Hunter Biden laptop story right before the 2020 election? Media, where are you? And Vivek Wadhwa joins me with his take on Elon Musk.
Elon is not a racist by any means, okay? He's not a white supremacist by any means. None of those things are true. The trouble is that Elon is consuming too much, too many drugs, I mean, or drugs of all kinds, and they're eating away at his brain.
We also talk with wealth advisor Ed Butowski of Chapwood Investments on the FTX scandal. How could Wall Street get flim-flammed so bad?
This has everything to do with people just blindly following something that they didn't understand, and they just threw tons and tons of money at this.
Coming up, baby. Hello, my friends. Hope you have a happy weekend coming up. I'm Dennis Neal, and here's what's bugging me today. Bad things can happen when the Democrats have a two-seat majority in the U.S. Senate, 51 seats to 49, as they will have now. I'm sorry to see Herschel Walker lose his Senate race in Georgia to that incumbent Democrat, Raphael Warnock. I've admired Herschel ever since I watched him batter the Gator defense when I attended the University of Florida long ago. To me, the surprise here, though, is Herschel Walker fared incredibly well, despite all the drawbacks that could have crushed him. The media smeared him for misdeeds and bad decisions in his life from a couple decades ago. His own gay son came out and renounced him on Twitter. I'm sure that had to hurt. And we'll talk Twitter in a moment. You know, Herschel was inexperienced in government politics. He's an ungifted politician, an uninspiring speaker. A Republican friend of mine was at a fundraiser for him in California just a few weeks ago. He says Herschel couldn't really engage or connect. It was, quote, platitudes cascading down like a waterfall. Yet Herschel won almost 49% of the vote in Georgia. A total of 3.5 million votes cast and counted. Herschel lost by fewer than 100,000 votes out of 3.5 million. Georgia has 159 counties in total, and Herschel won 132 of them. The Democrat won only 27 counties. The urban centers like Atlanta, Augusta, Savannah, and Columbus. So that reflects the same thing that's going on nationwide for the presidential vote. You know, look at how President Trump in 2020 won almost every state electoral college or counties across states, but then lost some urban centers where the libs live. A Democrat friend in Atlanta, very connected to politics there, told me last night the election shows that people strictly vote for party now rather than the person. Otherwise, she wonders, how could such a flawed candidate like Herschel Walker draw so much support? I think Herschel is a good man making up for a troubled past. Do the sins we commit long ago define us forever and make us unforgivable? Everyone has the right to start over and mend themselves and make amends and work to make it better. Herschel wanted to serve the people, and I admire that. Now I want to know, did anything behind the scenes at Twitter affect the flow of information and comments in the Georgia race? Were conservative views suppressed? Note to Elon Musk, please do another reveal. And that brings us to the Twitter files. If you are one of the 290 million Americans who are not on Twitter, you may not have heard about this monumental story. The New York Times, Washington Post, NBC News, CBS News, CNN, most media outlets have been ignoring this story for days or burying it. Elon Musk is the $200 billion man who spent $44 billion to take over Twitter only weeks ago. He wants to free it of political censorship and strengthen it for free speech and rid the platform of child porn and trafficking. Now, over the last weekend, Elon Musk began releasing the Twitter files, internal documents showing that these Twitter executives, they interfered the 2020 presidential election by smothering a New York Post story on the Hunter Biden laptop just weeks before the vote. Twitter having the utter temerity to do this is so arrogant and galling. Who the hell are they to second-guess the reporting of a 220-year-old newspaper? As a lifelong journalist, as a guy who wanted to be a reporter at age 10, I am so deeply offended by it, and yet I hear nothing from my journalist colleagues. I hear no outrage at censoring a real newspaper. Now, those emails on Hunter's laptop, okay, which he abandoned because he was, you know, high or something. They talk about Hunter making deals with, you know, and seeking contacts in China and Ukraine. Hunter saying he had to give a 10% cut to the big guy, meaning his dad. Videos and photos of Hunter weighing crack cocaine and smoking it with young ladies who weren't his wife. And I've seen even worse photos that we will leave undescribed here. Balenciaga, much? The FBI had the laptop as far back as December 2019 and buried it. And then the FBI met weekly with Twitter executives in the weeks before the election the following November. Now, warning that misinformation campaigns were imminent. Be careful out there. Now, did you get that? Think about that. The FBI, a month before the election, is talking to Twitter staff and warning them misinformation is coming because the FBI had possession of the Hunter laptop and knew it would leak. The Twitter files also show that the Democratic National Committee asked Twitter staff to silence the conservative actor James Woods, and now Woods says he wants to sue the DNC over this. The Joe Biden campaign had an open channel for contacting Twitter to point out the tweets it wanted taken down. Now, it used this far more frequently than any Republican attempts. You know, one email shows that a new batch of requests came in from Biden staffers, and a Twitter person responds, quote, "Handle these. Hello, Elon Musk. Next up, will you please show us every request the Biden administration has made of Twitter since taking over in January 2021? And maybe that's why the Biden administration is making noises now about trying to derail Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter by citing national security concerns. Saudi Arabia investors. Never mind that the Saudi Arabia wealth fund has $40 billion invested in U.S. stocks and put another $7 billion in just in the past month. So let's just pause for a moment of sanity, okay? If big tech manipulated things to hand the election to Joe Biden, so be it. I don't want to overturn it. The results are the results. They stole it fair and square. President Trump said some stupid things the other day when he talked about suspending parts of the Constitution, if necessary, to reverse the 2020 election. That was ridiculous. He should say he, quote, misspoke, like they always do. So instead, my focus is on how terrible it is that big tech could do this, undetected, unmonitored, unaccountable. I bet you this kind of interference was rampant at Twitter and Facebook and its WhatsApp sister and Facebook's Instagram platform and Google and its YouTube service. Let's investigate it. Let's expose the full extent of it so we know. And let's stop it from happening again. Investigate it. Expose it. Stop it from happening again. This is something any journalist should support and pursue. In my 35-year career as a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal and managing editor of Forbes, an anchor on NBC, CNBC, and Fox Business, all of us, the people I worked with, we would have seen this as a huge story. Where the hell are any journalists who are upset by the Twitter files today? This is something that should be an outrage to all journalists. But nobody's really reporting it. No one's that upset about it. Elon Musk is exposing the sleazy, symbiotic alliance between big tech and the Democrat Party, and America will be the better off for it. He should have been Time Magazine's Man of the Year, rather than the president of Ukraine, who, yeah, he is a hero too, just not ours. Elon Musk is an historic figure and an American hero with so much more to come. And when we return, you are going to hear an utterly opposite view of Elon Musk, that he's been using too many drugs and listening to the advice of idiots. This from a man who knows Elon personally. Vivek Wadhwa joins us up next.
The Biden administration is constantly finding new ways to fail and then blaming others for it. except when it is intentionally failing on issues like the border and energy policy. Well, we're not going to let them get away with that. I'm Greg Corumbus. Join Jim Garrity of National Review and me each weekday for the Three Martini Lunch podcast. We'll give you the good, bad, and crazy news of the day and lots of laughs, too. Find us right here on the Ricochet Audio Network at ricochet.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Welcome back, and brace your brain for a download from a really smart mind. Vivek Wadhwa joins us now, and I'm honored that he's here. Vivek is a tech entrepreneur. He's a distinguished fellow at Harvard. He's a professor for Carnegie Mellon in Silicon Valley. He's the author of Your Happiness Was Hacked, Why Tech is Winning the Battle to Control Your Brain and How to Fight Back. And thanks so much for being with us, Vivek. Let's start with Elon Musk and Twitter and the email that you sent out to your troops on November 14th. It begins this way, quote, and this is Vivek talking, guys. I expect that all of you are watching the greatest, parentheses, clown, parentheses, the greatest clown show on earth, Elon Musk self-destructing as he destroys Twitter. There are many management lessons to be learned here on how once great leaders fail, close quote. And wow, here I thought Elon Musk was doing great. The Twitter files, you know, election interference, FBI pressure. So Vivek, tell us, what is he doing wrong?
Dennis, to start with, let me set the stage here that I've known Elon for more than a decade right now. When New York Times was attacking him, I was writing for The Washington Post. I was a globally syndicated columnist of The Washington Post. I was defending him. My first article talked about me being a Tesla fanboy. I declared myself a Tesla fanboy. Article after article, whenever he got attacked, I was defending him. And Elon also got me my first Tesla out of turn. This was many, many years ago, 2012, 2013. There was a 6,000 person waiting list. He got me bumped up and I got my Tesla. And then he persuaded me to get my new Tesla, which was supposed to have full service driving in 2016. And, you know, the autopilot stuff. So I've known the guy. I've been out drinking with him. We have many common friends. And I used to call him the greatest innovator of our time. When the right was attacking him for his clean energy, and for, you know, being into solar and all of this stuff, I was defending the guy vehemently, right? So okay. Now suddenly he's decided, okay, I'm now a conservative and I'm going to suck up to all, you know, the right-wing people and so on. It's still the same Elon. The guy, you know, you and a bunch of other people may believe that he's a god now because he's saying all the right things you want to hear. But Elon is Elon. I mean, he doesn't have conservative values. Between sex and drugs and all the other things he's into, and the fact that one of his children, his daughter, is a transgender, and she disowned him, she divorced him. Okay, these are Christian values. These are the things that you folks, you know, look up to. China, he dare not say. He's all into free speech. He dare not say utter one negative word about China because he's going to offend them. And it's going to demolish his stock price. The free speech is only for countries that happen to have free speech where he can speak freely. He dare not speak against any of the authoritarian regimes. The guy is nothing like what you know. You and a lot of other people are touting because he happens to be releasing some emails. And also on the emails, wait until he starts releasing the emails that the Republicans sent him, or he gets into lawsuits and he has to release those. Suddenly he's going to become, he's going to go from being a god to being a demigod.
Okay. So I appreciate a lot of your points. None of them were in direct response, though, to what my opening question was in terms of Twitter, in terms of what he's doing to the platform and management lessons, what is he doing wrong? But before you answer that, let me just say that the guy's worth $200 billion. Like you said, he's the first car company in 100 years to challenge the big three. I believe his Teslas actually outsell as a luxury car, you know, BMW and Mercedes-Benz that have been around for decades and decades. I mean, the guy is like Larry Ellison said when he put $1 billion in January 2019 into Tesla stock. And they asked him, why would you do that? The short sellers are killing him. And he said, hey, he's sending rockets up in the air and taking them down and landing them on barges. No one else is doing that. What have you done? So I kind of want to root for him. I kind of hope that he does.
Dennis, I'm the guy who was defending him from the conservatives for the longest time. I was the one who was
to open up the platform. His intent is not to ruin it. His intent is to open up the platform. So what has he done wrong at the platform since taking over a month ago?
Okay, so far Twitter hasn't crashed. We haven't seen any disasters yet, but they also haven't released any new code. It's all frozen. Now, what he's done is he's demolished the company. It's fine. I mean, to have gotten rid of some of the extreme leftists. That I used to say that it was the lunatics who were running the asylum. I mean, that's Twitter. What Twitter has been. Okay, it was fine that he got rid of all those extremists, but what he did was that he just got rid of everyone en masse, so that now he has a skeleton crew. And even verified, he hasn't been able to release that because he's demolished the company. That's not how you take over companies.
Okay,
you
have to. If I may, I talk to a guy who goes into workout situations all the time, and he was telling me he's very technically inclined and he knows a lot of this stuff. He said there's no way they need more than a few hundred engineers to run that. You can't monitor 240 million people's comments with people. You're doing it with algorithms anyway. So the question is, how good are they? And when he fired half of that staff of 7,500, let's remember two metrics I love. One is they were spending the equivalent of $400 per meal on employee meals at the base because everyone was working from home, but they kept spending and spending. And the second is, I was astonished by this number. Is it high or not, Vivek? The median income level for all of these employees, median income level was $240,000 per year. Isn't that high?
Dennis, welcome to Silicon Valley. That's the way it is here. I mean, ridiculous salaries, ridiculous benefits. But the trouble is that when you take over a company, you get rid of all the deadwood. You don't start by slashing all your best people. So the best people who left and the H-1Bs who can't leave, these foreign immigrants who can't leave because they're on these visas, they stayed. All right. A lot of the best talent has left the company. And he brought his Tesla engineers in, his SpaceX engineers. But you can't just go there and just because you know how to write code and say, okay, I can write code. But we haven't seen the damage, that he's exactly done to the company yet. It's still early in the cycle.
They also did host a space, what do they got, Spaces or something, this live chat. And I think I read a million people or something.
All 100,000 people. But the key developers of Spaces have left. All right. So now if he wants to upgrade Spaces or if something goes wrong, he's in big trouble. I mean,
don't you think that his code and his coders are better than whatever Twitter had? I mean, that when he got in there, meet me here at this time, bring code you've done in the past month. You shouldn't be here if you haven't done code in the past month.
What you're just saying is it's like saying I've got the best football team and they're going to go and play great basketball. That's how it is in coding. You have to know the right languages. You have to know the architecture. You have to know how the system works. You can't throw smart people at it.
Okay, so far we haven't seen any bad impact of that, but he's getting lots of criticism for everything he's doing there. You've been out with him. You know him socially. He's done personal favors for you. So let me ask you, and they say, by the way,
I've done personal favors for him. Okay, he did it because I had done so much for him.
Well, so you guys have a relationship. Therefore, I think you know him better than I do, since I've never read him and I only read about him, and the same for the rest of us. So now let me ask you, and you're never supposed to, when you're an anchor, ask a question you don't know the answer to. And you and I haven't rehearsed any of this. Do you think that he is a racist white supremacist who is out to change Twitter into a platform for that?
No way, Jose. Absolutely not. Are you kidding?
Yay.
My first book, Immigrant Exodus, Elon readily endorsed it. Okay, the book touted the power of immigration and talked about how we need to bring the best and brightest in. Elon's CFO, Deepak Ahuja, was a good friend of mine, okay, Indian guy, okay, but he elevated him and he gave him carte blanche to do what he had to do to, help him build Tesla. Elon is not a racist by any means, okay? He's not a white supremacist by any means. None of those things are true. The trouble is that Elon is consuming too much, too many drugs, I mean, or drugs of all kinds, and they're eating away at his brain. And he's surrounded by people who are taking advantage of him. I mean, the fact that he spent $44, $45 billion on Twitter, it was vastly overpriced. I mean, Twitter was worth $10 billion at best, if even that much. Okay, and these people didn't care about his money. It was his money they were spending. And they basically, you know, whispered in his ears. And he's surrounded by a bunch of yes men who are giving him stupid information. And he listened to them and he's believing his own press.
Okay, by the same token, let's remember a couple of things. He put in his bid, I think, about in April before the market really started falling apart. The market was down a good, I think, 20%. And any bidder would want to try to foul up the bid and pull out and try to redo it, because the stock that you would use usually in an acquisition has gone way down in value. So that's the first thought. The second thing is, the thing no one else realized, and I wrote a column for this in the Wall Street Journal, actually, plug. You know, he saw it much, and you know this, I'm sure. He sees this as the everything X.com. He wants people on Twitter not to just screaming at each other and censoring each other, whatever. He wants them to start paying each other and doing transactions and companies and clicking on ads and buying things far more. I mean, the potential upside there is huge.
And he was trying to build a super app, okay? And first of all, he had a $1 billion walk-away fee from Twitter. If he was smart, if he had the right people advising him, if he listened to investment bankers instead of these idiots that he hangs out with, and I know who the idiots are, frankly. I used to hang out with them also for a short while. Okay, so if he would have paid $1 billion walking away fee, yeah, would have hurt his ego, he would have looked bad. And then he comes back in and says, okay, now you're worthless, I'll offer you $12 billion for this thing. Negotiate, he didn't do that.
That's an awfully good point, Vivek. You walk away, you take $1 billion fee, but then you come back and you ask for—
You ask again, because he would have destroyed the company in the meantime, and he would have gotten a bargain for it. If he had bought it for $10, $12, $14 billion, he could easily have doubled the value of it.
Yes.
Now, what is it? He bought it for $44 billion. You think he's going to increase the value to $250 billion? Not in our lifetime. So the trouble is that he got really bad advice. Elon at heart is a brilliant entrepreneur, good person at heart, okay? But like I said, right now he's being misguided by it's the people around him who are the problem.
I'm so happy that you could join us, Vivek. Thank you so much, Vivek Wadhwa, for sharing your thoughts with us. And man, guys, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure he comes back, okay?
All right, my friend.
Have a glorious day, Vivek, okay?
Anytime you invite me, I'm ready.
Hey, James Latitude, reminding you that just because the elections are over doesn't mean there's not stuff to talk about. There's lots. There's looking back at what happened. There's looking back at the stuff blowing up today and taking a look at the stuff that might be blowing up tomorrow. We'll talk about it all in the next Ricochet Flagship Podcast.
And we're back. You know what? I'll tell you, that talk with Vivek Wadhwa is going to make news. The guy was hurling balls of fire. And next up, I got a great guest for you to meet. Ed Butowski is a wealth manager out in Texas. He was a 20-year veteran on Wall Street, advising others and how to manage their money. The guy oversees hundreds of millions of dollars in other people's money. And I was delighted to be able to meet him some years ago when we did a book together that I helped him write called Wealth Mismanagement, in which he makes this basic argument: Wall Street, you suck at managing and assessing risk. And so now he's here to talk to us today in the wake of the FTX scandal, where they managed to lure money not just from a million crypto kids, but also $1.8 billion in the past year or so from SoftBank, Sequoia, Paul Tudor Jones, Tiger Global Management, some of the biggest names on Wall Street. Thanks for being with us, Ed Butowski. What do you owe that to? How could this happen?
Well, I'll tell you, by the way, you left out BlackRock, which is a firm that a lot of people have viewed as the quintessential, if I said that right, firm at managing money and taking care of risk. And that's what I love to talk about, is risk management. And this has everything to do with people just blindly following something that they didn't understand. And they just threw tons and tons of money at this and literally accepted on face value what this 30-year-old kid was saying to them. And that's not any way, that's not traditional wealth management risk assessment. That's just, plain just, common sense, that you do a little more homework where you're putting your money and where you're investing.
Talk about due diligence in this case. And were there warning signs?
Well, I'll tell you, the warning sign was that they didn't have the auditor in place. They had a very small auditing firm. And the other side of it is that they didn't have controls over what they were doing with their money. So a lot of this money was, you know, either, you know, absconded, or they took the money and loaned it to this Alameda hedge fund. And they
I've been writing a few columns on this, and it is rather stunning what they were doing, because you had the platform, and then they issued, you know, a couple billions of dollars in their own coins, tokens that traded on the platform by the hedge fund Alameda, run by his girlfriend, you know, who loves Harry Potter, we heard about from Forbes magazine. No controls, no board of directors. That accounting firm, the auditing firm you mentioned, I read this, that they are proud to have be the first accounting firm with an address in the Mediaverse, and they sponsor the DCL Baby Dolls, this scantily clad group of performers. That's their accounting firm. Now, the Wall Street firms, the big investors and the VCs, they had to know this, right? Why did they invest anyway?
Yeah, because this is a new area where people just thought that, you know, here you have this young person who's making all this money and was, you know, sort of the stronghold in that space. And everybody just wanted to believe, you know, things, and they continue to believe, you know, even though they didn't do their due diligence. You know, there's always one firm out there that looks into these things. And I'm sure there was one firm that said that this was all a farce. And it turned out to be correct. The same thing with Madoff. I mean, there's a lot of similarities to Madoff here, where
the
returns. And they
just three similarities.
Well, one of the similarities was the accounting firm. And you know, people just believed the returns as well without looking into what those returns were. The accounting firm and also, you know, the hoopla. You know, you had everybody talking about Madoff as though he's his, you know, darling of Wall Street. And the same thing with, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried. He was supposedly this incredible guy. He even went out and, you know, put money with Anthony Scaramucci, and you know, Scaramucci supposedly was a really smart guy, and Scaramucci,
very savvy investor,
$800 million in crypto, and his firm has gone from about $7 billion, I believe, in assets under management to about $2 billion. And that's not all because of crypto, but when you start hearing about, you know, Anthony Scaramucci is in bed with this guy, and all these other firms, Tiger and BlackRock is in bed with him, you just start to, you know, blindly give your money to this person. And what really got me is my son actually had $6,000 with BlockFi. And BlockFi, his money's gone. I mean, my son's money is just completely
gone. They just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, right?
That's right.
For those listeners who don't know, when a company files for Chapter 11, they're saying, hey, man, we're going to work out a plan to pay off our debts, and you creditors now are unable to sue us in court. And that's exactly what FTX did, and that's what they're in the process of working out now. Here's a thing that surprised me. All right, so this was a platform valued at a high of $32 billion a few months ago. It falls to less than $1 billion in assets. It owes $9 billion to other people, including 1 million investors, right? But I did not expect it then to wipe out $200 billion in crypto value. A lot of them are down 90%. And then it goes all the way into my retirement account, my IRA at Fidelity, where I bought Grayscale Bitcoin, GBTC. Now, I can't buy Bitcoin in my retirement fund, but you can buy that. I thought it was a pretty solid fund. Turns out it's run by a guy I interviewed when I was on CNBC, Barry Silbert. He was this brilliant billionaire, young guy, who did this first thing called second market, where people with private companies and options, they were able to kind of sell it into this market. You couldn't sell it on the regular market because they don't count. And so instead he created that, and then NASDAQ bought that. He then creates this great credibility, GBTC, my GBTC from the highs down 82%. What was I thinking, Ed? So how did that happen?
Well, you didn't listen to me, because I would have told you to stay away from it. Now, in terms of these ETFs that are in your IRA, you know, people want to say that, you know, these are separate, and they are separate. Bitcoin and Ethereum are separate from FTX, but I'll tell you, it does have that smell of crypto.
They trade as one, don't they? They all trade together.
Right. So a lot of people believe that Bitcoin will be back and Ethereum will be back and some of these other coins will be back. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't be selling those. But you know, you're talking about one being an exchange, the other being, you know, what is traded on it.
Right.
And, you know, so
in fact, Wall Street analysts did not uncover this. You know, when I was doing a lot of research on it, here's what I found it. November 2nd, that's before the November 6th tweet that went out on a Sunday morning from the CEO of the rival platform called Binance, where he said, right, I'm dumping $500 million in this FTX coin over here. And then everybody in the football stadium tried to get out one doggy door all at the same time. That's what happened here, right? But I forgot what my point was, where I was going with that. Pick it up.
Well, in respect to Binance, you know, you talk about a run on the market, and that was, you know, any investment you can make that has that much risk to it is not a good investment. You should never be in anything where people can run out the door and kill the value of it.
That's what I was going to say, is that for it to fall and tumble 90% in days, that if you've, all right, so Facebook has lost a lot of money. It's lost, you know, 70, it's down 60% and it's hundreds of billions of dollars, but there's still something there. And it took a long time to do that. That it falls overnight like that tells me that there's nothing underlying it, an intrinsic value holding it up. It's because it's crypto based on nothing, right?
Well, that's the way I feel about Bitcoin and Ethereum. Although people tell me Ethereum is a platform that other things are built on, but I will tell you that I believe Bitcoin has no real value. And the only reason it has value is because people, you know, assign a value to it. But there is nothing backing Bitcoin. That's why some people, you know, have said it, you know, crypto and Bitcoin is the greatest, you know, scam in history. And I'm not far from it.
I got to tell you, as the uninitiated and as an unsophisticated investor in all things crypto, it always bothered me that there are these people with computers, servers, and they're doing, quote, mining, as if they're out there digging for stuff. No, they're trying to unencrypt this really tough, encryptable equation so that they can make some of that stuff. But if you're making it, and anyone can make it, if only they can burn enough electricity to unwind the code, it's just something weird. To even call it mining is to act like it's something real, like you're grabbing something physical. Gold is something physical that you mine for. And in the entire 5,000 years of gold, I think we have literally 3 or 4 Olympic swimming pools. That's all we've come up with. But this is nothing.
That's right. It's almost like taking an ice cube that is crypto and then melting it into water, and then it just disappears, it evaporates. And that's what this can do. That's probably a pretty good analogy to what crypto really is, because there is nothing there. It just becomes air. And I believe in the long run, especially when regulation comes into play, that Bitcoin's gonna become worth zero.
It's just that. I was talking to another really big guy in this area just today. And if there were a collapse, a default by the U.S. government, because, you know, our U.S. government's been paying $350 billion a year, roughly, in interest, no matter how big the debt was, because of our zero interest rate policies for the last 10 years. But now interest is going up to over $1 trillion a year just on interest on our debt, right? Well, if it were to keep going up, the U.S. defaults, the entire world collapses. Now, I think personally that the entire world will then flood into the U.S. as the one least risky place, and so that we'd be okay. But this guy was saying, no, then maybe would you go into crypto? Would you want some off the books or away from that banking system? Would you want something, you know, away from JP Morgan being able to tell you, we're not going to allow you to use your account to buy a gun? You know, what about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I would say that if you look at the correlation between the stock market and crypto, they're highly correlated to each other.
So it's just the same thing.
If everything went
with no intrinsic value beneath it.
Right. And, you know, so I would be buying diamonds. I'd be buying gold. I'd be buying cans of green beans versus putting money in crypto.
Huh. And, you know, there is this fear of missing out angle, right? Because, you know, you say that, and then suddenly something soars 70%. It's just that which do your clients get more upset about? Missing out on some opportunity that soared, or instead going into something that then plunges or goes down significantly?
Yeah, there was a Harvard study done that people are 2.5 times more emotional about losing 10% than they are of making 10%. So people get a lot more emotional about losing money than they do missing out on making money.
So when it's down 10, they feel like it's down 25.
Yeah.
It's two and a half times.
Right. And then they turn to people like me and say, my goodness, what have you done to my life? And they're like, my goodness, you know, the market's down 20%. You're only down 10%. I didn't do anything bad to your life. And, you know, over time, you know, things have a way of, you know, resuscitating and coming back. But, you know, to have the money in crypto, there's no real reason why this is going to come back. I know some people who are analysts on crypto, which I don't know how you become an analyst on Bitcoin. But these people claim to be analysts on Bitcoin and saying that it's very cheap right now.
Well, yes. Well, Sam Bankman-Fried, understand, I wrote a column and I pointed out that Fortune magazine did something like five stories in the first 6 days of August of earlier this year on Sam Bankman-Fried, quoting him on all this brilliant stuff. And one thing he said was that Solarium, S-O-L, this crypto, that is by far the most undervalued, best stable coin out there right now. I got to tell you, it's down 98%. So, and yet they were treating him like he was this oracle and this soothsayer. And the broader market, let me ask you, well, I got you here, because I remember something that I learned from you when we were working on Wealth Mismanagement, your book. You come out in the book and you say, everyone tells you, 60% stocks in your portfolio and 40% bonds. But basically, bonds are terrible. They've never kept up with inflation, not for 40 years. And no portfolio should have one. And yet we always do it because it's supposed to counterbalance stocks. What happens, folks, is that when stock money leaves stocks and those prices are falling, it floods usually into bonds. And when you send the prices of bonds up because there's more dollars flowing in, it makes effectively the interest rate go down, right? I believe I got that right. Yeah. And so, but what happened this time is that the market peaked in November 2021, and then huge declines in NASDAQ, especially because it was up far more than the S&P 500, but also bond prices fell. Where was the money going, Ed? Why did that happen? They should have been going up because money should have been flowing into bonds, sending prices up. And instead, bond prices fell with stocks. How rare is that?
It's very rare. In fact, if you go back to 1928, we've only had four time periods where they had stocks and bonds both down in the same calendar year. But this is the only time they were both down more than 10% in a calendar year. In fact, they're both down about 15%. So this is very, very rare. But in terms of the 60-40 split, going back into Wealth Mismanagement, the idea there is that bonds rarely ever keep pace with inflation and taxes. So anytime you could get 4 or 5% on a bond, the reason you can get that is because inflation has pushed it that high. And then when you take taxes out, you've lost purchasing power. I actually just redid the numbers the other day through November 2022. And if you went back to 1995 and bought one-year CDs or money market or one-year bond, you lost 0.91% purchasing power. That's after
of the 1% that you were... What does that mean? You lost 0.91% of purchasing power. That is, you were behind each year by that much?
That's right.
So well, you're supposed to be earning a percent or something. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So even if you were earning, so there were sometimes, since 1995, you were earning 5 or 6%. But because of inflation and taxes, you lost on average 0.91%. So you never have a good reason, unless there's liquidity needs where you need money in a 6 month period, should you be in fixed income.
Okay. Except
if you're buying senior rate floating notes and business development companies and preferreds, because those pay an extraordinarily high amount of interest.
Okay. But the other day, my Fidelity advisor called wanting to find out whether I was interested in some bonds, because short-term bonds have really kind of spiking high rates. In fact, everyone worries about this inverted yield curve, right? And supposedly it's a predictor of recession. And that what they mean by that, guys, is that you should be able to get higher interest rates for tying up your money for 30 years because of fears of inflation or whatever, than rates for tying up your money for only 2 months or for 1 year, right? I've got right. But what happens with an inverted yield curve, that what they mean by that curve, it's if you look at it on a big graph, like a fever chart or something, and instead you can earn more money by just committing it for only 2 years or less instead of more than you earn on the interest rate for 30 years, right? Now that's a bad thing, isn't it? And yet for short-term bonds, why not put money into it?
Well, because you're looking at those short-term bonds being two-year, and that it starts to, the curve starts to flatten out at around 5 or 6 years. But, you know, we're also talking about a minimal amount of money. You know, you're talking about getting, you know, 4% on short-term, and then you're looking at inflationary pressures being, you know, 6-7%, and then you take taxes out. So it still doesn't make any sense, you know, even though if you're just looking at the yield curve, it might make some sense. But when you then start to look at the real return, it doesn't make any sense.
Then instead, where should that money be put right now?
For fixed income type of investments, you should be looking at business development companies. They're selling at discounts to their net asset value. They're selling at discounts of about 10 to 15% of what they're worth, plus they're paying out about 7 to 8%. So you can buy an FSK, which is Franklin Square, which is managed by KKR. You can buy that at a 20% discount, make 12% on your money. And to me, that's a no-brainer because you can get a value, the value of your holdings can go up, plus you're getting 12% income. You're looking at a 20% total return.
Where do you find that? Where do people shop for that kind of thing?
Well, they call me.
Is this through private placement stuff? It's not like you can go on online and search for stuff to invest on that, is it?
You go to bdc.com. And you can find a whole slew of these and senior rate floating notes as well. Senior rate floating notes are short, or they're notes that are issued by banks. And then firms like BlackRock, Nuveen, KKR, Apollo, Eaton Vance, they securitize them and then they sell them off. And the interest rate that they pay goes higher as interest rates rise. So a lot of these are paying more money than they were a year ago. Now, the value of them have dropped, and that's not the case with the BDCs. Most of the BDCs are trading at higher prices this year, but the senior rate floating notes, for some reason, haven't traded higher, so you're getting those at really nice discounts as well, and then you also buy preferreds, and this is where you should have your fixed income money, and nowhere else but those places.
Okay. You know, Ed Butowski of Chapwood Investments out there in Plano, Texas. Ed, I got to tell you, that's a great, you've just done a great job of lighting a candle instead of just cursing the darkness there. Those are some really good ideas. I'm sure that my friends at Ricochet could freak out when they hear this because they're saying, oh my God, investment advice. And so they'd want me to put in some really quick notice right here in which I should point out that Ed's views are his own and they don't represent anything to do with what's bugging me and the podcast. And furthermore, before you make any investment decisions out there, you should do your own homework. You should seek out your own financial advisor or whatever, and don't be coming blaming us for some mistake you make. Because one thing we learned in FTX, as I've mentioned here, maybe in last week's episode, is that flim flam requires the complicity of the victim. You know, I mean, I wanted to kind of get some Bitcoin into my, retirement account, right? So that's on me. That's my fault. So if you listen to Ed and you lose money, that's on you. So there is my disclaimer. And I hope my friends at Ricochet think that that will suffice. Ed, I'm so glad to see you. You're looking awfully good. We got to get you back on for some more investment ideas, but also to talk about what it's like to go through a real rough health struggle and just keep persevering and keep pushing through, because your ability to just keep looking for that bright side instead of going with woe is me is what I think kept you alive. And so I would love to hear about it if you're ever willing to talk about it.
I'd love to. Thank you very much for recognizing that. It's been a tough go.
All right, my friend. It's great to see you. Have a glorious day, Ed Butowski, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you have a glorious weekend, not just a good one. I've learned only in recent years that the better I feel about life and the more I appreciate it, the better my life gets. This is kind of a contrarian idea in these days of so much griping, so much sewerous and lamentation of how terrible things are. Systemic racism, microaggressions, white supremacists, destroying women's sports, destroying our country. I have a saying, nothing can destroy us unless we let it. All this negative wallowing, I call it shopping for umbrage. People who are so upset about so many things things that really have nothing to do with their personal lives and their quotidian existence. I love that word, quotidian. It means merely daily, but daily is so boring. We're unable to change the events that already have happened in our lives. The fights with our spouses, the slights from our bosses, whatever travails come to challenge us, the loss of loved ones. We cannot change any of that. But I have learned that we can control how we choose to view these events and whether we draw good lessons from them or instead choose to see only negative things. These negative events that can consume us, they aren't really reality. I know it sounds weird, but it's a great point. I heard this in a debate I saw online between a philosopher and a legendary pioneer in DNA research. The philosopher pointed out that while a scientist sees reality in the physical, this chair, that coffee cup, that event, true reality lies inside our hearts. Reality lies in how we feel. And from that, I took the idea that reality lies in how we choose to feel about things. I choose to see the positive. For 30 years, I was a journalist at some of the most famous media platforms in the US, and it was my job to seek out the negative. What's wrong with this picture? Who's getting screwed here? Who's upset? Where's the conflict point? I was an editor for a lot of years, and I was always asking my reporters that. Find that and build your story around that conflict. That is, in part, the duty of journalism. I mean, Ben Bradley, the famous editor of the Washington Post during the Watergate scandal, he made a speech at the University of Florida when I was in college long ago. He came by the newspaper offices later and I met him. Such a great moment for an aspiring young journalist. And he told us, newspapers don't print stories on planes that land safely. But it puts you in a negative mindset, being a reporter and always looking for that, you know, looking for a fight, looking for someone upset. I spent a long time in the media as this angry young man, fueled by an inner drive to get readers to read my stories. You got to hype when you type. Now, I don't know, maybe this is based on some insecurity I felt inside myself. My feeling, you know, somehow disrespected or undervalued and wanting someone to listen to me. I think we all want someone to listen to us, though, don't we? This negative bent, though, it's even worse now in the media. It is part of the business. Ad sales require engagement. Engagement requires outrage, umbrage. Entire stories and follow-ups are created simply when one famous person says something really stupid that they shouldn't have said. See Kanye West, yee. Or when one person disses another boldface name online. That isn't news. It rarely was before, but it is considered news now. And it does drive clicks. Always it's about the clicks. On this podcast, even though it's called What's Bugging Me, I want to avoid a lot of the anger and outrage and shopping for umbrage that you hear out there. I want to light a candle and point out the upside and argue for solutions. Now, this is a kind of a Ferdinand brand of optimism. It might irk some cranky people out there. Ferdinand was that, you know, children's tale about the bull who always wanted to stop and smell the flowers. Remember that? These days, I love to smell the flowers. That brings me back to the DNA research pioneer and the philosopher. The philosopher talked about a rose. You can describe it scientifically and photograph it, and you can give it its species name and phylum and genus. But a rose, this philosopher said, a rose doesn't really exist in your own personal reality until you hold it and inhale it and smell it and feel whatever those olfactory sensations bring up inside yourself. I like that definition of reality. It can be as beautiful as we want to make it. That's it for now. And like I said, have a glorious weekend.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.